heard about some of the fellows from here in the Cimarron area that had some pretty tight spots when they were in World War II. One was Herman Werner, who was one of the fellows that manned a tank destroyer in the European theater over in France and Germany, and he had, I think, two or three of those tank destroyers blown out from under him, and he was wounded several times, but he just came back and served till the end of the war.
Tell me what a tank destroyer is.
Well, a tank destroyer had a heavier cannon on it, and I think they were 90 millimeter, and they could penetrate and a German Panther or even a German Tiger tank.
So it was one of those large guns.
It was mounted essentially on the same kind of a chassis as the old Sherman tank.
Oh, okay. All right.
Except it had a heavier gun and it didn't have a big turret like the Sherman did. Then another fellow from Cimarron, Clarence Crick, was a fighter pilot. And he was on his first mission over Europe, and he got shot down and spent, I think, about 2.5-3 years in a German prison camp. But that was not a very good luck thing to get shot down on your first mission.
Did he tell you anything about the conditions in the camp?
No, I just heard that and talked to him a little bit about it, but he never said anything about the camp. I didn't ask him at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And another fellow that from here in Cimarron, part of a large family, was Ralph Monicle. And Ralph was in the Navy, and he was on the Yorktown in the Pacific. And he had, I think, four sisters who were in the Navy and maybe five boys, and I think they were all in the Navy one place or another.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph had an older brother named Russell Monicle, and Russell had joined the Navy in 1940, I believe it was, and he got into the submarine service and served on a submarine named the Finback. And he told me they were coming through the Panama Canal headed for Pearl Harbor when Pearl Harbor was attacked. And he said they got there a couple days later and they were still fishing bodies out of the water and trying to cut through the hull on the Oklahoma to get some people who were still trapped inside the Oklahoma that was rolled over on its side. Another fellow that was at Pearl Harbor, who's still there, was Dwight Roberts, and he lived in a house down below the railroad tracks down here, and he was in the Navy, and he was on the Arizona when it blew up and sunk. Mm-hmm. And I know I'd been to that memorial in Pearl Harbor and still see those little bubbles of oil coming up from that ship that's there. Another fellow that had an interesting time, and I didn't talk to him, I heard this, a fellow named Oscar Swenson. He was raised in a house up across from where the swimming pool is now in Cimarron, just south of it. And Oscar, I understood, when he got in the Army, he just volunteered every time somebody wanted to volunteer for something, and he ended up in Merrill's Marauders over in Burma. And somewhere I heard the story he was telling about one of their scouts was out down one of those jungle trails, and they were under orders don't shoot for anything because they didn't want the Japanese to know where they were. And this guy came up against a tiger on the trail, so he just stopped and kind of looked at the tiger and just waited and waited, and finally the tiger ambled off into the jungle to one side. But he said he was that scout was just petrified. But of course the Merrill's Marauders were later dismantled when they returned from Kitchener, where they took that town on that railroad, and their trip, of course, across those jungles in Burma was a terrific ordeal. But I don't know what happened to Oscar after they were dismantled over in India when they got back from their mission, because they dissolved Merrill's Marauders at that time. another fellow who was in the Marines, I think he joined the Marines in 1940, was Don Imroth from here in Cimarron. And he served on in several of those island invasions. And Louis McGuirk told me that when they were on Saipan, and they were, he and a couple of his other buddies were down behind some logs, and there was a lot of heavy fire coming overhead right through there. It says the Marine came from the way the fire was coming and dove over the logs and landed on top of them, and it was Don Imroth. And so he stayed with him for a while till the fire died down. And they said he was coming back to get some more ammunition so he could go back up to where his other fellas were. And I thought that was kind of unusual.
So they didn't know that he was there?
Anecdote. Well, no, I don't think so. Okay. I'm not sure whether they were in the same division. Mm-hmm. Probably must have been pretty close to the same sort of a same regiment or that sort, because I didn't know exactly what Louis, forgotten the name of the which Marine division he was in. And Don was a career man in the Marines. He never was injured, as I understand it. And he made the march from the Chosin Reservoir in the Korean War when they fought their way down that valley to get out of the North Vietnamese. They were up close to the Yalu River, and of course the Marines put people up on the ridges, and the Chinese were trying to knock them down all the way across, and it was terrible cold and a very tough campaign to get down there to get out, and that was a big deal. Another fellow that was raised here in Cimarron, they called him Squirt Kramer, is Marvin Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
And Marvin, as I understand it, was a gunner or a driver on a half track with a armored unit, and he was part of the group that was a very lead group that were trying to close the Falaise Gap there after Hitler made a counterattack into after the D-Day, and we closed that pocket on them, and Squirt was part of the group that was trying to link up with the Canadians and the British to close that gap. Mm-hmm. And they did get it pretty well closed, but then a lot of German troops got out, but they didn't get out with any equipment. And that was our Germans lost a lot of people in that, because our Air Force was dive bombing those troops on those roads. And
how are you spelling that? Falaise.
Falaise, I think. Falaise.
Okay, so it was in France?
It's in France. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
all right. It's east and a little bit south of, I'm trying to think of the big town that the British had such a hard time taking, at Caen.
Oh, okay. Caen. All right, if I could interrupt a little bit. You know a lot, evidently, about World War II. So is that how you heard all these stories, because you were interested and you just started talking to these men, or?
Yeah, well, I'd heard what some of them, where they were, and would visit them a little. Some of them would talk quite a bit, others wouldn't say a whole lot.
Right.
And some I just kind of heard about them. I never got the chance to talk to them directly.
And have you always been interested in?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the war? I mean, I don't know how old you are, so.
Well, I'm 72.
Okay.
But I was too young. I was six when I was born in 1934.
Okay, but you were aware that the war was going on because of the conditions here.
Oh, yeah. I remember that D-Day announcement that Eisenhower made about the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we'd heard about Pearl Harbor some years earlier, and we didn't, of course, I didn't realize quite all the impact of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another person I'm thinking of who I know had an implement business here in Cimarron, was Harold Eddington. And Harold was in the Army when the Japanese were attacking in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And Harold was captured when they captured Bataan.
Oh.
And he made the death march and lived through it and lived in that, it was one of those prison camps until they were liberated
mm-hmm.
later in the war. And it left him pretty shaken. But he lived through a terrible ordeal with that.
Were you able to visit with him, or do you just know that?
I talked to his wife quite a bit, Doris Eddington.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I used to mow their grass when I was a kid here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And they just lived up the street in the northwest part of town.
Did he ever talk to his wife about it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's where I kind of learned. I didn't know he'd made the Bataan death march until mm-hmm. I talked to her.
Mm-hmm.
Another fellow that lived here, was raised here, Miller Jantz, and he was a radio man on one of those B-17s. I think they made 29 missions or so over Europe, and they were very fortunate because they didn't usually go more than about 20 missions till they got shot down, or mm-hmm. 15. We lost an awful lot of airplanes in that cruise in those early years of the air war over Europe. Another fellow that from Cimarron who was killed on Iwo Jima, and I learned this from Louis McGuirk told me. Because Louis was on the invasion in Iwo Jima, and he was talking about going by one of their first cemeteries they set up, and he was looking at some of the grave markers there, and he came across Harry's marker, and he inquired and found out that Harry Grant, he was a well-liked young guy here, mm-hmm. good athlete, and smart, and worked hard, and he worked for a farmer up northeast of town. He used to build himself up, they said, by lifting 5 gallon cans of gas up the back of the truck and so forth. But he was a BAR man, a Browning Automatic Rifleman. Louis said he talked to him when they were in Hawaii, when they were getting geared up for the voyage to Iwo.
Mm-hmm.
But a mortar round came in on he and another fellow in a shell hole, of course, mm-hmm. killed them both.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what happened to Harry. He was a Marine. Louis McGuirk, Louis was a close friend of mine. He and I worked a lot with scouts, and his son was in the scouts, so we did a lot of things together, and Louis was a good friend of mine because we bought vehicles from the McGuirk Chevrolet, and Louis had a friend in the Marines, he called him Smokey. He was a engineer, used to, from West Virginia, and he was an engineer in one of those coal trains when they'd mm-hmm. be pulling those coal trains out of the coal fields there in West Virginia, heading to wherever they were taking the coal. And he talked about on Saipan, they had an old staff, they'd taken the island, and they were found this old locomotive, and they were sure wanting some hot water, so Smokey looked her over and figured out how to fire it up, and so they got hot water, and he was talking about they had more casualties in that particular area than guys trying to open up coconuts from with their knives. So but Louis told me about the invasion on Iwo, and he was part of a bazooka team, he mm-hmm. and Smokey. And it says Smokey looked over the side of the landing bar and saw all this smoke and everything on the Russell Monocle being on the fin back, that mm-hmm. submarine. He was, they were all in the Southwest Pacific, and they got one place, his commander, they took him into a kind of a closed harbor, and they put a torpedo into a big supply ship that made a great big explosion. Apparently it had a lot of ammunition and so on, and they just barely got out of that lagoon where they'd been in there. And it was incidentally, it was the Finback that picked up George Bush when his plane went down the Pacific. So that was an interesting little sideline.
Mm-hmm. I think you were talking about the landing on Iwo Jima, and Smokey was getting ready to say something.
Yeah, Smokey looked over the side of the landing barge and saw all this smoke and all this stuff going on the beaches mm-hmm. in there. And so he said, "Well, we're the first thing we got to do when we get to the beach, we got to find a hole, get in a hole." Then he tossed the ammunition over the side for their bazooka. And he said they got on the beach and in this hole, and they're, of course, trying to figure out how to stay alive. And so one of their sergeants came back and said, "Hey, we need a bazooka team up here." And Louis told him, "Smokey lost his ammunition on the way in, Sarge." And I don't know, he didn't say much about what, I never did talk to him about what else happened after that. I assume they were in on some tough stuff. And once they got off that beach, and then they had that terrific fight to get the rest of the island after it took Suribachi.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned about Harry Grant.
Right.
And let's see, I mentioned about Dwight Roberts on the Arizona. He's mm-hmm. still there.
Mm-hmm.
And Millard Chance with his so on, and Harold Ennington. And I think ready to ask Buford about some of his stories that his dad told him.
Okay, so but let me just say,
why don't you tell the ones that you know of Dad, and then I'll fill in anything.
Okay, I'm just going to say your name here so they know that it, Buford Rohrbaugh. Okay.
Buford's one of Don Rohrbaugh's sons, and I was a good friend of Don's, and Don and I worked together with Boy Scouts a lot, and Don's wife worked at the Cimarron Insurance Company for about 25 years.
Okay.
Was an underwriter, and knew his mother very well, and they were good friends of mine. Don told me about how they, one of his experiences, he was over in Europe when the bulge started, but I think this was a little bit before the bulge, and he, German burp guns was a submachine gun that the Germans had, and whenever they heard one of those going off, they figured somebody's pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were back there in some rear echelon. They were in kind of a rest area. Some rear echelon guy had gotten hold of one of those burp guns, and he shot it off, and they all dived for a trench, and it turned out to be the latrine. So he didn't like that. They were about to get rid of that behind the lines guy. But Don told me about one experience he had, that his unit was, they were along a general line, and they had these jump off positions, and his unit, his company, got ahead of where they were supposed to be, and the Germans let loose a big artillery barrage, and it landed where they would have been if they hadn't been that far out. But they were digging in along the, I believe this is, was the way it was, that along the sugar beet field, and it was cold. Ground was frozen and hard to dig in, and they were digging in on this sugar beet field, and there was a kind of a ridge over ahead of them, and the roadway came along that. And then they heard some German tanks coming right along that road. He told me, he says, "It's surprising how much faster you can dig and dig in hard ground when you hear a tank showing up." And then he told me about in the bulge, he and some of his unit captured a bunch of Germans in some little village, and there were twice as many Germans as there were the Americans, and they herded them into this barn, and he said they didn't have anything to eat, and we didn't have anything to eat, and they finally parlayed back and forth, and they let two of the Germans go to get some food.
Uh-huh.
Well, they came back with some stuff that they could eat. And then the other thing Don told me about, and I'm not sure just where this occurred, but it's somewhere in that time frame, where he and another fellow were going along a railroad track, and they saw one of these little huts that they kept their tools that they repaired the rails and screw the spikes in and plates and so forth. And he says we jumped inside that little shack because a German 88 opened up on them, and they said the first round was short, and he said the second round was long, and he told her, he said, we ought to get out of here, that next one's coming right here, and it sure did. And that's, I think, when it knocked him out of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really about all I can remember, some of Don's stories. Okay. And all that. Buford correct what I missed there.
Okay.
And he'd probably tell you more.
Yeah. I've got a copy of, my son-in-law is in the Army now.
Okay.
I don't know where he went to get this, but it's a combat narrative for the 84th Infantry Division, which is what Dad was in.
And do you know when he was, I take it, drafted, or did he enlist?
He volunteered.
He volunteered.
Yeah, it's always been a sore spot between my mother and him. He left here with, she had four little kids.
Oh, my.
But his two brothers, Raymond and Orville, both had farm deferments, and Dad was county clerk at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he got word of some talk around town about the Roybal boys not doing their part.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went down and volunteered and without consulting mother.
And do you know what year that was?
44, I think.
44, okay.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's when he went over. And he started out, he volunteered for the Army Air Corps,
mm-hmm.
went through basic, went to tail gunner school for the B-20, for the B-17, and then his paperwork caught up with him, and they found out he was 34 years old, and so he was too old for the Army Air Corps, so they sent him back to Little Rock, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He had to do basic again and come out as a radioman in the infantry.
Okay.
And I'm not sure which regiment he was in. I think it was the 335th okay. Infantry Regiment. But they landed over Homenhaw Beach, but after the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And then they fought in Holland and France and Germany and Belgium. And he said they hadn't been there but just a few days, and they were in their first action, and he was, one of their sergeants got killed, and they wanted to give him a battlefield commission to sergeant, or, you know, raise him to sergeant. And he told the lieutenant he had one ass over there and he was gonna get one ass home. So he wouldn't do it, but I think he was a corporal at that time. Mm-hmm. But
did he ever comment on, was his training adequate? Before he went over, was it adequate when he went
over? The only thing he ever told me was when they were in the, see, they sent him up to around Marche, Belgium when the bulge started, and they were cut off immediately and surrounded. And when the one that Sid was talking about that captured the 64th Panzer Division.
Oh.
They had, where they set up, there was two dump truck fulls, just piles of landmines. Mm-hmm. Dumped out there along the side of the road where they were taking that position. And they didn't do anything the first day, and then the second day they got to thinking, you know, if an artillery round had hit those landmines, it'd be pretty catastrophic. So they just, everybody grabbed a handful of them and they walked out on the snow and just threw them out, and another guy come along and pulled the pins, and they didn't do, you know, you're supposed to map your minefield, and they didn't do any of that. They just wanted to get them spread out. When it, of course, it snowed every day. And it snowed over those, and then the 64th Panzer had circled around behind them and come in behind and run off into that minefield that they'd laid, and they mm-hmm. had two bazookas, so the bazooka guys was laying down and shooting the rockets across the flat field, and as they would skip, they would set off more of those mines. So they,
uh-huh.
and the commander of the tank brigade or division or whatever it was, he got shot five times below the waist coming out of his tank when it got knocked out, so he surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they ended up with the guys in the barn. They had 60-some tankers and 100-some infantry, and they didn't have anything mm-hmm. to feed them.
So once the commander surrendered, then the others did too?
Yeah, the Germans did.
Okay.
And Dad said, you know, they were all schooled in the arts of war, and if they were outgunned or outmanned, mm-hmm. they surrendered.
Okay.
He says something to the Germans never understood about the Americans, because he said you give a GI five rounds and a rifle, and he'll take on a company. You know, mm-hmm. But Dad said that's when he realized that one thing they never taught him in all of his training was how to surrender. He said the Germans, you knew when their heads went on their helmets, they were done.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, nobody'd ever told us how to do it.
Hmm.
And
did he talk a lot about his war experiences?
He did a little more to John and I, because we were so much younger than mm-hmm. the others. I was born in 49 and John was born in 52. So he didn't talk. The other kids, we get together and talk, and they haven't heard any of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard. And then the other thing was we had television, and we had things like GI combat on TV and stuff. And I remember Dad would watch that with us once in a while, and he made the comment one night that whoever was there, technical advisor or whatever for GI combat, he said evidently he was there.
Mm-hmm.
And what brought it up, a squad was going on patrol, and it was in the hedgerow country or trees, and these shows them walking behind this row of trees
mm-hmm.
out in the field. And I said, shit, I wouldn't. I'd be in those trees. And Dad said, well, no, you wouldn't. Dad said, no, you wouldn't, because the Germans had all those hedgerows zeroed in with 88s. If mm-hmm. they saw any movement, they could put the first one right on top of you. He said, mm-hmm. you walked behind them in the fields, because as rule, the first one was long, second one was short, and the third one was right there.
Okay.
And so they...
I didn't know that was a rule. If I'm ever in a war, I'm going to remember that.
Well, that was just, he said, seemed like that's just the way they ranged them in.
Uh-huh.
But by the third one, it was going to be right there. And I sit talking about the roundhouse, when Dad got wounded, that was a tank that got him. Moving so fast that supply couldn't keep up.
Mm-hmm. And then that ended his stay in the war.
Yeah, that's when he got wounded, because they were going back at night. The supply would notify the frontline units where they were going to leave a truckload of supplies. Might be food, might be ammo, whatever. And then it was up to the frontline mm-hmm. units to send guys back to that road junction, pick it up during the night, take it up to the frontline companies. And Dad and the guy that went with him to get it took a wrong turn and drove right through the front lines. And they come up on a railroad track, and there was a Tiger tank sitting over there. And so they bailed out of the truck and run down the railroad siding, and that's when they run into this building. Well, the Tiger blew up the truck, and then the only thing that saved their life was that Dad said he doesn't know whether the door wasn't on the building or mm-hmm. they just didn't bother to shut it. But
They could get out fast.
Well, they shot that 88 right through the door, but it was point detonation, went off on the back wall, and they got the backflash of the...
Oh.
And that's what shrapnel cut his arm
mm-hmm.
pretty bad. And mm-hmm. the other guy got shrapnel through the cheeks of his behind, and that was...
Hmm.
But it knocked them both dinging.
Yeah.
I remember... I'll interrupt Buford a minute. I remember Don told me about... they were behind a little... hedge in one place, and as he mentioned, Don's a radio man, and he said one of their medic went out to get a fellow that was wounded, and the Germans shot the medic,
mm-hmm.
and somebody else popped out, one of their guys started shooting up where the German machine gun was up above him, and it was a German MG-42, and he said, and Don and his lieutenant or captain, they hollered anyway, "Don't shoot, you're giving away our position." He says that machine gun turned and said he just was sawing that hedge off right above their heads, hit the radio on Don's back and knocked it out. He said, "I was never so close to the ground in my life as it was then." And he says that guy was just sawing that hedge off right above us. And he said another thing about those big cement fortifications the Germans had in there, and he said you could tell how many in there were in that thing because how many shells you'd count on the mm-hmm. outside, and they'd want to get around behind one. He said you never went ahead mm-hmm. head on.
Are you talking about those concrete bunkers with
pillboxes?
Slits?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they'd find out where the exhaust fan was, and they'd drop hand grenades down there and tell them to come out, or they're going to ready to take care of them. Mm-hmm. And but I remember that he could always tell how many were in there by how many spades were mm-hmm. sticking in the dirt outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said when they yeah. took those pillboxes, the artillery would tell them, wouldn't tell them how many rounds they were going to get, but they would tell them the color of the last one. The smoke would be a different color.
Oh.
And he said you had to cross that irrigated beet field, that bench, mm-hmm. to get to the pillbox, and you had to be close enough to keep the door shut with small arms fire before you got the color.